Welcome to Law in the Bush, a regional, rural, remote podcast by the University of New England's Law School.
Welcome back to Law in the Bush. I'm Lisa Ward, and today we're speaking to Aileen Kennedy, a law lecturer at UNE's Law School. Welcome, Aileen.
Thanks, Lisa. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
It's an absolute pleasure. What's been your legal and academic journey to becoming a law lecturer at UNA?
When I studied law, I didn't think about becoming an academic. I instead edited a legal journal for a couple of years. And then I decided to go to College of Law, and I was in practice for a long time. I also did some teaching immediately after I finished uni. And I always liked it, so I decided to give it a go and applied for a job at UNE and got the job. So a bit of a chaotic journey, really.
Excellent. And how did you get to where you are now with the focus of your research on human rights for intersex children?
I really hadn't intended to look at that. I was doing a lot of research on body modifications, so looking at things like cosmetic surgery and voluntary amputation. And I'd also done some research on female genital mutilation. And in my PhD, I decided to look at the way in which neuroscience was giving insight into people's sort of bodily relationship to their bodies. And so I started researching on the idea of transforming the bodies of transgender and intersex children according to their brain sex, according to their gender identity. And when I started researching on intersex, I was really shocked at the way in which their rights were just completely trampled over, and the history of law and medicine's engagement with intersex people was really shocked and surprised me. And the more I looked into it, the more surprised I was that there wasn't more outcry at the way that intersex people have been treated by society, by the medical establishment, by the legal establishment. And so that's when I started working on that and writing on that.
And law lecturers in such a wonderful position to try to push for changes.
Yes.
Yeah, we certainly are. So could you describe the importance and impact of your research?
Well, at the moment, I'm on the board of Intersex Human Rights Australia, which is an intersex advocacy group. And as part of that work, I had the opportunity to sit on the expert reference panel of the Human Rights Commission doing an inquiry into intersex human rights in a medical setting. And also I've been working with ACT and Victorian governments on introducing legislative change to stop medical intervention on intersex children. I probably should explain a little bit about what intersex is. Is that okay if I do that?
Yes, please do.
Intersex people are born with bodies that aren't characteristically stereotypically male or female. And so that somebody might have female chromosomes and female uterus and ovaries, but they might have genitals that are more masculine because they might have been exposed to high levels of testosterone in utero. So usually intersex variations are genetic. So people have their genetic, the gene sort of manifests in a way that produces a body that's not, that sex characteristics are some combination of or not stereotypically male or female. So the example I described, one example is congenital adrenal hyperplasia, where in utero the fetus gets high levels of testosterone and their genitals then develop in a more masculine way. Another example would be people with male chromosomes and male gonads, so undescended testes, but because they don't have any exposure or are immune to testosterone in utero, their genitals develop in a very female way. And so they can grow up looking very female. So they would have vagina, clitoris rather than a penis, but they still have male genes and male gonads. So these are the sorts of variations that are called intersex. So anytime a person has an unusual, non-orthodox sex characteristic. So another example would be Caster Semenya, the runner from South Africa, who has female genes, female internal gonads, but she has very high levels of testosterone. And so she looks very masculine. So those are all examples of intersex people. And the medical establishment's response to intersex is to very early to change their bodies to look more authentically male or female. So performing sterilization surgeries, performing genital surgeries, and providing hormone therapy to change.
Why is this an issue for how medical profession or how doctors respond to children who are intersex?
Well, a couple of reasons. Firstly, because it's not medically necessary, and a lot of people whose bodies have been feminized or masculinized are very resentful of the fact. Often these surgeries aren't very successful in terms of things like if you cut down a woman's clitoris to be the right size, then you're often going to impose or you're going to impact on a person's sexual pleasures and function. So that compromises their sexual feeling. Or they might be given hormones that make them feel, that are very uncomfortable. Hormones have a lot of side effects in terms of how they make people feel. So in that sense, it's something that people should be allowed to decide for themselves instead of doing it when they're children. Also, sterilizing procedures, rob people of the opportunity to have families, to have children themselves. And this is all done on the basis of parental consent. So the issue is, first, there's an argument that bodies don't need to be changed just because they don't look orthodox, but also that if they are going to be changed, it should be done at the behest, at the decision of the person whose body is at stake. And also, a lot of these, they don't produce bodies that are more functional in any way. They produce bodies that have got lots of scars and often need multiple surgeries to make up for these problems. And sometimes they also choose the wrong gender. So they assign children to be male or female, which is fine. I mean, everybody should be assigned male or female at birth, but you don't have to kind of bolster that by changing that person's body to look, especially their genitals, to look more conventional when they're infants. So before the age of two, this stuff is usually done.
I have read that there's been mistakes made of people who are born hermaphrodites with two sets of genitals, and then they discover, so they might make them male, and then they discover later that they have internal female organs.
I should clarify that hermaphrodites is not regarded as an appropriate term anymore, but also because it does convey the wrong idea. People aren't born with two sets of genitals. They're born with genitals that might appear unorthodox when you compare them to their genes, for example. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And what's the policy outcomes that you hope will flow from your research and being on boards to governments?
Well, we're hoping that there will be a sort of across-the-board prohibition on performing these surgeries before the person is old enough to consent, unless there's medical necessity. So some intersex people have medical needs that have to be looked after. So for example, some forms of salt wasting, and they require urgent medical treatment. So of course, we're not trying to stop that. But what we're trying to stop is the surgeries that are really just there to quell any discomfort about the idea of people whose bodies aren't sort of orthodox in, you know, don't fall in line with the stereotypes about what men and women should look like.
And a lot of this happens to Australians, all over Australia, regional, rural, remote.
Absolutely.
And in cities. How does it affect them?
Well, if they live outside of an urban centre, then they will have to travel usually to, say, Sydney or Melbourne to get treatment, or Brisbane, where they have specialised teams that perform these surgeries. So children born in regional areas normally won't be treated within the regional area. They have to go into the city to get assessment, diagnosis, treatment. Often the treatments that are imposed are, they're sort of configured as one-off treatments, but they will sometimes require multiple surgeries. So for example, where the surgeons construct a vagina, that often has to be, often requires, you know, four or five surgeries throughout childhood right into adulthood. And generally speaking, intersex people lose a lot of time in their education to medical treatment, often unnecessary medical treatment. And as a consequence, intersex people as a group have much lower educational attainments. Their employment prospects are much worse, and their average income is much lower than non-intersex people. And often this is attributable to the kind of medicalization of intersex conditions and this requirement that people undergo repeat surgeries and repeat medical interventions.
You're listening to Law in the Bush, a law research series about regional, rural, remote law by the University of New England.
A state by state approach, and are any states doing it better than the others?
Well, at the moment, Victoria and ACT have both made public pledges to improve conditions for intersex people and have made very explicit, has sort of developed very explicit policies prohibiting intersex treatments without proper consent, or non-urgent treatments without consent. So they are definitely, you know, ahead of the game. The Human Rights Commission released a report last Monday, a week ago, recommending that all governments follow suit and prohibit unnecessary medical interventions on intersex people. And they identify the sort of, it's as common, it's sometimes quoted as being as common as red hair. So even though it's regarded as very rare, about 1.7 people have an intersex condition. So it affects a lot of Australians.
Sorry, was that 1.7%?
Yes. So, you know, you can see that that's a high percentage. I mean, you know, in population terms, of people who are affected by this paradigm of treatment that's been dominant since about 1950, even though it's undergone some fairly severe criticisms and challenges, it continues to dominate treatment in Australia, in all Australian states. So
it's really so wonderful to hear that, being on the board and it being backed up by all the research you've done, is having an effect. But it's not just you, you're interacting with other researchers. And how did you find them?
Well, Intersex Human Rights is a really fantastic organization that's been around for many years. And when I first started writing on this, I got in contact with some of the people working there. I'm the only non-intersex person who's on the board of Intersex Human Rights. So it's very much an intersex-led advocacy organization. So, you know, there's that expression in a lot of communities that nothing about us without us. I'm definitely kind of a supporter of intersex people leading these changes, and they've done a fantastic job in terms of putting this all together and really pushing. They've been pushing for this for years, and it's, you know, it takes a high toll on people to have undergone these medical interventions and been very unhappy, and then to see it continuing to happen to children right up to today. So even as we speak, there's, you know, each year several hundred intersex children are receiving sterilization, hormone therapy, and genital surgeries. Their consent. It is shocking.
And do you find it challenging being on this Australia-wide board working in a regional university?
It is a little difficult. I guess that COVID has done us a bit of a favour, hasn't it? By making Zoom meetings much more common. Prior to COVID, you know, it was important that I'd be at various meetings. So I did a lot more travelling. And so to attend the Australian Human Rights Commission's expert reference panel, I would fly down to Sydney for a day to sit on that panel and talk with other people. But these days, luckily, a lot of that is taking place by Zoom. I feel like we're sort of catching up. And I mean, I suppose there is a disadvantage working in a regional university, but I'm quite interested in looking at what the prospects are for intersex children living in regional areas and how they can access support and access necessary treatment, how they can access different kinds of support. And if they do decide as they grow older to undergo different medical procedures, the access to those sorts of treatments.
It's really quite cutting edge research that you're doing. I mean, really at the vanguard there. And I use that word about a Facebook post about you today.
Oh.
You teach as well. Any of your units informed by your research?
Oh, definitely. One of the units I teach is contract law. So obviously that's not particularly relevant, but I also teach three different health law units. I teach medico-legal issues, and that is fairly broad brush looking at different issues about consent and medical negligence. But I do teach 1 week, sometimes 2 weeks on intersex and trans issues, so looking at law relating to children and gender. I also have another unit called neuroscience and law. And in that, there's a module about brain sex, so about the idea that our brains are fundamentally male or female and how that might be impacting on people's gender identity development. And then I have a third unit called contemporary issues in health law. And sometimes I've had a module in that on intersex issues. And next time I teach you, which will be in 2023, I'll have a module on intersex issues in that unit as well. So definitely there's great, I'm very lucky to have the opportunity to teach units where there's this really fantastic synthesis between my research and my teaching.
And that it's up to date and dynamic.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, no, this is a changing field all the time. When I first started researching on it over 10 years ago, even though there had been a Senate committee investigation and inquiry into it, into the issues, that was just generally ignored by governments. But since that time, the issue's gotten a lot more traction and I think is really on the, as you say, it's cutting edge and it's really important and it's getting the kinds of attention that it's that it deserves.
And where to from here? What's the current research or what's next?
Well, I've just finished my PhD, so I'm really looking forward to getting stuck into a couple of different issues. One thing I think is really interesting to look at a comparison between female genital mutilation and intersex genital surgeries and sort of making comparisons between the reasons why people perform these surgeries, particularly why parents. People are often baffled as to why mothers of daughters in, you know, other countries perform female genital mutilation, but we don't ask ourselves why parents in Australia perform genital surgeries or consent to genital surgeries being performed. And so, you know, I think there's some...
Sounds exciting. And are you looking for collaborators?
Always. Yeah.
They can contact you through the law school, and there's a link under the podcast to the law school.
Yeah.
And are you looking for any HDR students or masters or honors students?
Yes.
In these topics?
Yeah, oh, for sure. Yeah, always welcome, you know, working with other people, including HDR students who are interested in these issues. This is really a burgeoning area of investigation. So another thing I'm going to be working on is looking at different ways, different forms of legislation to protect intersex human rights. So do you prohibit only surgeries on intersex children, or should it be something that applies to all children or even all adults? So, it, you know, all these sorts of these different decisions have different consequences. Do you implement criminal prohibitions, or do you do it all via, you know, civil or maybe even disciplinary proceedings? So all those
things. All open.
Yeah.
The possibilities are endless.
Still lots to talk about.
Fixed. Because people often think of law as being fixed, but it's not. You can make...
No. And you know what's interesting is this is taking, you know, the area of consent to medical treatment of children has always been in the realm of best interest, which is the kind of family law understanding of how we best look after children is by looking after their best interests. But yeah, it's been found that sometimes best interest fails to take into account human rights issues like the right to bodily integrity, like the right to an open future and things like that. So, you know, this is really interesting. I think we're at the cusp of a new way of conceptualizing children's rights and children's best interests. We are more through the lens of human rights issues, more through the lens of looking at their, you know, likely future, not just their immediate interests. And so I think it's a really interesting development in law.
We're going to keep watching this space. More to come here, Aileen. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thanks so much for talking to me, listening to me, Lisa. It's really, I love talking about my research, so it's been a great opportunity.
It's no surprise because it's really exciting stuff. And thank you again.
Good. Thanks, Lisa.
Thanks for listening. We want to hear from you. Please fill out our survey in the link below.